Remarkable writers who knew Toni Morrison well, Angela Davis, Sonia Sanchez, and Nikki Giovanni, visit our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Harla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriana Contreras, Maria Tarasena, and Renee Feltz. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, and Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
When Jesus walked the land, in Judea and in Galilee, they ruled with an iron hand. And the poor were sick with hunger, and the rich were clothed in splendor, and the rebels whipped and crucified hung rotting as a warning. And Jesus knew the answer, said, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's," said, "Love your enemies." But Judas was a zealot, and he wanted to be free. "Resist," he said, "the Romans' tyranny." So stand up for Judas and the cause that Judas served. It was Jesus who betrayed the poor with his word. Jesus was a conjurer, miracles were his game, and he fed the hungry thousands and they glorified his name. He cured the lame and the lepers, he calmed the wind and the weather, and the wretched flocked to touch him so their troubles would be taken. And Jesus knew the answer, all you who labor, all you who suffer, only believe in me. But Judas sought a world where no one starved or begged for bread. "The poor are always with us," Jesus said. So stand up for Judas and the cause that Judas served. It was Jesus who betrayed the poor with his word. Slaves against their masters, but the poor against the poor. Said, "Sons, arise up against father, and brother to fight against brother. For he that is not with me is against me," was his teaching. Said Jesus, "I am the answer. You unbelievers shall burn forever, shall die in your sins." "Not sheep and goats," said Judas, "but together we may dare shake off the chains of misery we share. So stand up for Judas and the cause that Judas served. It was Jesus who betrayed the poor with his
word." And here we are. Good morning. Someone unplugged the microphone cable here in Studio 2 for some reason, but we got that straightened out. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Good morning, everybody. Yes, it is a day that some people call Christmas. I'm not a big believer myself, which will be the subject of today's conversation. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. I'm here alone in the KBOO studios with my board up. Asia, thank you for being here. Asia, and well, we're not alone because you all are out there listening. And we got a number to call in, 503-231-8187. So yeah, of course, I wanted to start out with Leon Russellson with his epic song, Stand Up for Judas. He's actually got a really good explanation for that song, if I can find it here. Got a little thrown off by that start, but yeah, so I want to talk about how official holidays are used to keep us in our place, keep us docile, keep us enthralled to the myths of the imperial culture that we have grown up with, whether it was in Rome and the Roman Emperor Constantine's declaring, well, making Christianity an official state religion, and the declaring of the 25th of December as Christmas to seemingly, well, basically immediately to take over from what was celebrated as a Sol Invictus, the basically stemming from the ancient celebration of the winter solstice. Anyway, just in I'm going to read some articles here, but and then and there was also the Roman festival of Saturnalia, starting on the 17th of December, going through the 23rd, and being a time where, I guess what became known as the Lord of Misrule, sort of an overturning of the established order, and basically an outlet for the lower classes to sort of turn the tables on the elites for a brief period of time, basically as a kind of a vent, an outlet, so that basically things could continue as normal. But, you know, at least there was an outlet. And this is similar to what happened in the colonies. The Puritans were the first ones who declared war on Christmas, something people have heard about over the last decade or two, that the right wing has brought up to oppose the supposed so-called political correctness of people challenging the establishing of a state religion, which should be outlawed by the First Amendment, in the nativity scenes being sponsored by counties, cities, states, the celebration of, even the celebration of Christmas is a national holiday, for crying out loud, and people, wanting to include other religious traditions, many of which do have their own holidays around this time of year, whether it's Jewish, of course, African Americans established Kwanzaa, which I don't know that much about, but certainly cultures around the world have celebrated midwinter as being a really important time of the year in all cultures historically, before mass religions, celebrated the seasons, had the seasonal rounds of celebration, which with the rise of patriarchal monotheistic religions got generally swept aside. So yeah, I mean, I think this is important. I think it's just too easy to fall in to these superficial traditions that have been passed on to us that basically hide a very troubled history, and sort of basically as a the KABU program on Thanksgiving Day, the genocide cover-up day, serves this same basic function. All these national holidays, which end up glorifying consumerism and the nation state. I know a lot of people don't want to talk about this on Christmas morning, but I do. You can always turn off the radio. But there's probably people who do want to talk about this because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people who listen to KABU are not followers of the dominant culture. And I applaud you because it's not easy. It's not easy to be, you know, sometimes the only one in your family, one of the few in your peer group to think differently about these things. So that's what I think KABU is provides an outlet for. And that's what I am trying to do here on KABU Radio. Of course, the song that we started, Stand Up for Judas, is a different thing than I'm sort of hinting at, the role of Christmas itself as basically a cover up or a way to deflect attention from what's really going on. He, Leon Russom, who himself was Jewish, his dad's fled from the pogroms of Russia, and he settled in the UK. His family, and he's if you ever listen to my early first and third Thursday folk show, I play a lot of Leon Russom, and he's one of my favorite singer-songwriters. I think his lyrics are some of the more biting and relevant that I've come across. Anyway, his take is that the emphasis on Jesus as being sort of the savior and the so much focus of world attention is really deviates our attention from. And he himself, according to Leon Russom and others, was basically not really was. There's a lot of anti-Roman, what we would call decolonial or anti-colonial movements going on in Judea, in Palestine, against the Roman Empire. And what he's saying in his lyrics is that Jesus actually, in saying that give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and love your enemies, he was more of a quietist. He was sort of deflecting the energy away from direct resistance and towards something else, a more mystical. And this is something that's really stayed with us throughout history, this sort of dual or multiple response to empire colonization and the dominance of powerful patriarchal hierarchies. And so that's something that I would like to talk about. Maybe you have something else you would like to talk about. Sounds like we have one caller already on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning, this is Camilo.
Hello, Camilo.
I told the person on the board that I would take the bait. But I have a somewhat slightly different stance. My family background is from the Caribbean, Trinidad and Tobago, where we have perhaps the second biggest carnival in the world, after Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. I was also married to a carioca citizen of Rio de Janeiro for about 7 years. So I'm familiar with both. And I think what they represent is the really clever way the Roman Catholic hierarchy was able to infiltrate internationally around the various cultures that they, in a sense, occupied by incorporating some of the myths of the indigenous lands and making them sort of co-equal. And the same thing is true of Voodoo in Haiti. And one of the first events of Carnival is the day on Monday where you go out in costume in these really kind of ridiculous scenes of the reversal of the order where the powers are mocked and made fun of. So, you know, we have a way of ventilating all that frustration and oppression that we've lived from one year to the next with, and it's just given vent. And on Wednesday, Ash Wednesday, you let it all go and you start Lent. And I think they really were very, very crafty in the way that they were able to sort of have this cultural infiltration that managed to do what you describe as a means of controlling the population in a way that was not as oppressive or offensive as the others that they used.
Well, yeah, it's the, you know, the carrot and the stick. There, in some circumstances, you use outright oppression, and other circumstances, you use a sort of a co-optation or repressive tolerance, I guess,
yeah,
is a term that I forget who coined that phrase. Herbert Marcuse, I think.
It gave us a great cultural treasury, and you know, it's not used for the same purpose anymore, but people are still in need of an outlet one way or another, because things really haven't changed that much in 2,000 years, have they?
No, that's true. I think they've just gotten worse and worse. But the idea of an outlet, I guess, is what I'm focusing on, because, you know, I think we're all constantly caught in this, you know, whether it's caught in needing, having our own individual and, you know, small group needs to like live our lives and not be ground down, and to, you know, to want to just live our lives. And so, of course, we're going to take whatever opportunity we can to, you know, whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's movies, whether it's carnivals, you know. But the problem is in a mass society, you know, imperial context, it's different than in a small scale village tribal context where you actually do, you know, where those have the original meanings. The meanings always get diluted and transmuted by the use by the imperial powers and the elite powers that need to keep people in check. So it's really hard to, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to go against those powers. So most people don't, and most people do just choose the easier route.
Yeah, I think thinking about what you're saying makes me think about what we just heard on Democracy Now! About art, and what those conditions you just described do is they make us become very clever in how we figure out how to expose what we're experiencing, and that's really what art does. Unfortunately, people who are skilled and intelligent and well versed in understanding have been able to take this information and to turn it into something creative that's available for us. You know, I just regret that more people aren't able to enjoy the more profound interpretations rather than the comedy that they give us, you know, as our daily bread.
Indeed, indeed. Well,
Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and I just want to publicly acknowledge that I appreciate you, and that you really started me off in a great measure in terms of my involvement in environmentalism, and it was really due to recommendations that you made to me maybe about 5 years ago. So thank you.
Well, no, thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, that's why I do radio, is that I do. Thank you so much, Camilo, for saying that. I appreciate that. All right, we have open lines, 3 open lines, 503-231-8180. 8-7. So I just want to go into a little more deeply this idea of the Lord of Misrule. And, you know, because, again, this idea of the war over Christmas has really, you know, muddied the waters. It's another attempt by, you know, the powers that be, mainly Fox News and their satellite of misrulers, continually try to redefine what's the actual resistance to elite rule in this country and around the world, which, you know, most of it comes from people from, you know, identities, classes, ethnicities that are marginalized and suppressed. And so the challenges to Christmas on the basis of it being sort of a de facto state, you know, establishment of a state religion are totally valid, but it gets twisted around as being this supposed war on Christmas. And so it's interesting and instructive to go back further into history and see that the battle for Christmas, as Stephen Nissenbaum wrote in his book, which I haven't picked up yet, but I've read several reviews of it. It's really very interesting. And I'll just read a little bit from some reviews. Christmas traditions are far less organic than we are led to believe. Using countless sources from diary excerpts to almanacs, illustrations, and children's books, author Stephen Nissenbaum unravels the mysteries of Santa, Christmas gift-giving, and more in The Battle for Christmas. How did winter misrule evolve into the child-centered domestic affair we know so well today? Having read reviews beforehand, and this is from Kate Thomas, I knew The Battle for Christmas covered more than reindeer and tinsel, but the scope of the book still surprised me. Nissenbaum considered every angle from which to view Christmas, the politics that shaped it, the religion that resisted, then reinforced it, and the economies that commodified it. Nissenbaum's writing is dry and slow at times, but his research is impressive, and you have to admit the topic's interesting. Beware, though, the book may turn you into that person who ruins all the fun at Christmas parties, as some might accuse me of doing right here on KBOO. The Battle for Christmas is made up of a preface, 7 chapters, and an epilogue. The first 2 chapters are the most informative. They cover the early history of Christmas in America, wherein you learn the holiday was not some quaint cultural import, be it from Anglo-pagans or Christians, but rather a carefully crafted modification of an existing winter misrule enjoyed by the working poor and begrudgingly tolerated by the wealthy. Some of the wealthiest, men we might now call Scrooges and Grinches, created the modern Santa and other Christmas lore. This is very fascinating, the idea that, you know, this is a very consciously created holiday, again, to channel energies and economic activity back into the hands of the wealthy. So, reading about wealthy societies' contempt for the poor they disenfranchise will have you laughing in disbelief and maybe even feeling a little nauseated. The subtle and other times blatant class warfare documented in this book makes you realize how far American society has come. It also makes you realize how much work there is left to do. Anyway, so yeah, again, apparently, and I wasn't really aware of this, amazingly, thinking myself an educated person, how this whole, you know, in a way, sort of Saturnalian festival continued, I don't know what the continuities really were, but into the colonies, that this is something that had gone on for quite a while through Europe, that, you know, is a time of, well, as a, you know, of wassailing, which is this group singing going from door to door, where people actually sort of challenged the wealthy to give gifts. It was a minor redistribution of wealth, and a lot of public drunkenness, which obviously the Puritans didn't like, Anyway, there's a lot to unpack here, but we got another caller. So go ahead, tell me who you are and what would you like to talk about?
Oh, this is Joe, and it was ironic that you called in, or you started talking about this book as I called in, because I called in before you started talking about it. Old Mole Denise Morris and I did a review of the now classic stop animation Christmas special about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and I researched a bit about the history of the story of Rudolph, and I knew it was relatively modern innovation. But what I really didn't realize is like how cut from the cloth of commercial society Rudolph's story was. Rudolph was a character conjured by a guy making coloring books, writing stories for coloring books for Montgomery Ward, the department store back in the 1930s. And we reviewed the classic stop motion Rankin and Bass produced Christmas special that I grew up on, and I'm sure lots of people grew up on that and the other ones. And we looked at closely at how the innovation on Rudolph's story and the original story are this kind of ideological conservation myth around difference, around how do you deal with people who stick out in some way when you have a system that enforces or expects conformity. And it became really apparent to me how the myth of Santa's toy shop, which is, again, one of these modern innovations that don't stretch back into any traditional culture stories or anything, is, this weird side story that is in conversation, however unconsciously, with global realities of global capitalism, with colonial extraction and the movement of materials and goods overseas, and it tells that story, I think, especially for children, in a way that makes them invested in that global reality and all the more confused about what it's really about.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking of playing a clip from, I had on a month ago, John Harold to talk about gaslighting in the context of so-called mental health. And he, in his talk he gave earlier this year at the Peer Apocalypse conference for mental psychiatric survivors, peer support people, he had a long take on gaslighting in the context of Santa Claus, and the it was very interesting, and it really speaks to what you're talking about, in that this whole idea of that Santa Claus, that kids, basically, he's saying that we sort of get indoctrinated into this idea of Santa Claus and sort of a conspiracy around this mythical Santa Claus. And it's sort of, in a way, it sort of gets children to accept the idea that there are these myths and fictions that we have to uphold, even though we know they're not true. And it seems harmless, just like Rudolph seems harmless, but they really do hide something much, much deeper, that basically they, what consumer capitalism does is it superficializes everything and makes everything come at us so fast and furious that it's hard to go back upstream and get at the original roots, which you and I are trying to do.
Yeah, that was something that Denise and I kind of came to a conclusion around, is that especially in these 1960s and 70s stop motion Christmas specials that have now become classic, and they show on like at least two networks every year or something, that they are there's always these crises. Some of them are often environmental. There's a big winter storm in many stories that's going to disrupt capitalism, that's going to disrupt the, or not capitalism, that's the subtext, but that's going to disrupt Christmas. And there's this constant question of like the reinvention of Christmas, of the saving of Christmas, of the retelling and the reinvestment in the Christmas story. And that's, I think very much what's going on in these modern tales is this, it's not even that it has to be about capitalism per se. It's going through the maneuvers of a psychological kind of setup where it teaches us to be invested in all of these other things. Or it teaches us to be invested in the people who speak from the place of authority, who will in one moment tell us Christmas stories and in another moment tell us to go to school or go to work.
Indeed. Or like the Wizard of Oz, you know, the Oz figure who's this, you know, this all-powerful figure who then, by the magic of cinema, gets revealed just to be a real human, but leaving in place the reality of, you know, the Oz of capitalism, the Oz of patriarchy, the Oz of empire, whatever. Yeah.
What's the name of that book that you were referring to just before I came on?
Oh, The Battle for Christmas by Steven Nissenbaum.
I have to read that before next year and do some extended reviews of the whole series.
Yeah, it came out in, I think, 2012 or 2013, and made from what I see, a bit of a splash at the time. But yeah, as all such other things, it has a short shelf life, so we have to continually... I haven't read the book, but all the reviews, it looks really, really good. But we got a couple other calls, Joe, so thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
All right. Well, let's go right to our next caller. Go ahead and tell us who you are and what would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm George, and I'm a KBOO supporter. And while we're talking about mythology, I would like to mention the mythology we have sometimes about other countries. And one of them that I began to read a bit about and see that it's not as simple as I had been told was the Soviet Union, which was an embattled country from its start.
And are you going to tie this into Christmas? But that's okay. You don't have to.
Oh,
go ahead.
Actually,
go ahead.
This
I'm
has
just joking.
To do with something a little different, which is, how could I put it? Displacing the myth that we have about our own country as somehow a heroic but tragically flawed effort to create a much better society, and in the only way that that's possible within capital. And there was a few decades ago a country and several countries that decided socialism, you know, and Cuba managed to do some things. But I found a book, is advertised, about the Soviet Union, which the reason I bought it was that the author was saying much that you heard about the Soviet Union was mythology. And I bought the book, and it's called Blood Lies. And the subtitle really says a good deal about it. The subtitle is The Evidence That Every Accusation Against Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union in Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands is False. And I don't know if you're open to my mentioning some of the things that the author of this book, Blood Lies, he's a historian who teaches at a New Jersey college today, I believe. His name is Grover Furr. And I don't know if you're open to my mentioning some of the things that he says.
Go for a couple.
Okay. One of them is that the Soviet Union, according to Grover Furr, was far from the horrifying evil place that we've been told. On the other hand, it was a very embattled country in which terrible things happened, but that Joseph Stalin didn't deliberately do them. That's one of the things he maintains. And another one was that the Soviet Union did achieve some start on some of the most important problems, such as breaking the 1,000-year grip every 2 or 3 years of famines. Those are two things.
Okay. So were there not gulags?
Were there not what? Gulags?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He says that. And On the other hand, he points out that we've had a lot of mythology about the Soviet Union handed to us by our establishment.
Well, that I'm totally prepared to believe, that there was exaggerations, but it seems to me that the exaggerations had some kernel of truth in a lot of, you know, that it you know, there seems like a lot of people who came out of the Soviet Union did talk about sort of a culture of basically, you know, everybody spying on each other to some extent. That's not true?
Well, one of the things about eyewitness testimony about countries, which has turned out to be worth pursuing, is the idea that when you look for finding out about the truth about a country, there will be people who will show up, and some few maybe may say it's a great place. Many others will say, and they often seem to be the ones who get the publicity, well, I left because there were horrible things that happened, and I'm willing to bear witness to this. And the Soviet Union produced quite a few of these people. But when I started reading this book, I thought, well, it's not the way I had thought, maybe. And you've maybe heard of Timothy Snyder?
No, but I think this is a really interesting topic, and I know you've called in and talked about this on some other shows, and it is an important piece, because the Cold War was just a massively influential. It was, you know, it was a way to justify massive increase, you know, is to justify the nuclearization of the world,
yep.
Justify, you know, the continued U.S. imperial designs, war, you know, wars, deposing legitimately elected or chosen leaders around the world. Yes, it was, of course. And so the depiction of the Soviet Union as the incarnation of evil was a crucial element to that. So I'm definitely open to relooking and revisiting. I'm my feeling is, though, that the Soviet Union, as such an embattled country, did tend to take on some of the aspects that I think its critics imputed to it, that it sort of did become a very repressive place, is my understanding, my feeling, but I could be wrong, so I should go in and check
let
out.
Let me say something about that, if I may.
Go ahead.
One of the things that happened to the Soviet Union, not only immediately after the Bolsheviks took over in 1918, they took over in 1917, for about 5 years, 14 nations tried to overthrow the Soviet Union and failed by 1922. But after that, there were other efforts made to cause damage to the Soviet Union economically. I don't know the whole history. I have a book about it. But the Soviet Union continued, and every time there was an effort to overthrow by infiltrating or creating dissension within, the people of the Soviet Union showed that, well, we may have a problematic regime being run by Lenin, or later on from 1924 or 5 on by the Politburo under Joseph Stalin, but it's a better country than we seem to have had before, and we're going to stick with it. And this is one of the things that Grover Fur brings out in Bloodlands, that there were horrible things that happened, a disastrous famine that killed, well, a million people or maybe or more around 1920.
George, I think we you're going, this is a really important thing, but I think we have some other callers.
Okay. I'd mention Grover Fur's book, Blood Lies.
Okay, that's an important...
And it's $25, and Powell's or other stores can get it for $25.
Okay.
Thanks for your patience.
All right, no, I love what you have to say. Thanks, George.
Okay, bye for now.
All right. We're talking about myths in general and lies that the empire tells us, so that definitely fits under that for sure. But it looks like we might have another caller. Do we have another caller?
Hey, good morning.
Okay, go ahead.
Good morning. Hey, just to briefly piggyback on that last caller, one troubling thing to contend with is the fact that a lot of the democratic socialist countries of Western Europe would never have come about you know, with their generous welfare states and all that sort of thing, had it not been for the existence of the Soviet Union. And I think, you know, we're seeing austerity and rollback, and we're seeing, you know, the total corruption of the American political system, you know, undermining Bernie Sanders. And unfortunately, I think we can, you know, we're not going to see any kind of democratic socialism, because it only existed in Western Europe because of the threat of the Soviet Union. Following World War II, the CIA was so terrified of the Soviet Union that they actually helped democratic socialism along in Western Europe. But anyway, I don't want to go off on that tangent. Michael Parenti's done some great writing about that whole topic. I guess the reason I called, though, Paul, is I was thinking of Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol. And I think it was once said that no one helped spread Marxism more than Charles Dickens. So, like, you take something like A Christmas Carol. There's the Alistair Sim version, and I'm if I remember correctly, someone says at one point, if the poor die, better they do it and decrease the surplus population. And then there's the famous line about, are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses for the poor? You know, if they have no refuge. So. Anyway, in my life, the works of Dickens and movies like A Christmas Carol, they really helped, you know, take me down a more radical path. And I wanted to ask you, Paul, like, what do you think of folks like that are in the Plowshares movement? I know, like, when Vietnam was ramping up, there were several public suicides. Like, there was a Quaker that publicly committed suicide, Norman Morrison. Roger Allen Laporte was with the Catholic Worker Movement. He committed suicide in opposition to the Vietnam War. I know Daniel Ellsberg was inspired to release the Pentagon Papers because of a Christian activist named Randy Keller. And Randy Keller eventually was imprisoned for refusing to pay war taxes in the 1980s. He wanted nothing to do with funding the covert wars in Central America at the time. And there's something about the Plowshares movement. Like, if we, you know, if the political system is totally corrupt and there's nothing we can do about that, and you know, violent resistance is unethical and counterproductive, we can't do that. And general strikes are almost impossible to organize. Like, I feel completely alienated to our society. Like, it's a complete travesty as far as I'm concerned. Consumerism, imperialism, capitalism. It's like. It's like oil and water. Like, I don't fit anywhere in this world. And so what do you think of, like, the Plowshares people who go on to military bases and, you know, symbolically, you know, do damage and get incarcerated as a result of that? It just seems like if we can't do general strike, if the political system is totally corrupt, then there's part of me that, like, believes that we should stop paying our taxes to support the military, you know, war machine. And we should all go to prison, just walking en masse onto these bases and saying, you know, okay, fine, you're going to have capitalism, imperialism, consumerism, you're going to kill the planet, that's fine, but you're going to have to build these huge, huge, you know, even bigger prison systems to incarcerate all of us who are just going to have nothing to do with
any
of this.
Well, my initial response is, I admire the hell out of those people. I love individual small group acts of courage and resistance. My next response is that you say we should all go to prison, and there's a catch there, because those acts didn't inspire that many other people to do what they did. So we're not all, you know, that's what a lot of people, you know, just, I think that's a myth as well, that somehow, you know, just doing an individual act of civil disobedience resistance is going to make other, you know, inspire many other people to do it. That's not.
I think you're right, Paul. Like, I actually agree with what you just said, but, like, part of your conscience, don't you feel we've reached the point now where, like, just taking another breath of air in this consumerist, imperialist wasteland, like, just taking another breath of air outside of incarceration is just wrong. I don't know how you feel about it, but it's like, it's not even mental illness if you're having an appropriate emotional reaction, if you're feeling despair and depression. It's not that you're necessarily insane, it's that you're having the appropriate human reaction to what is this nightmarish moonscape of ecocide, imperialism,
and consumerism. I think you're posing, You know, I think you're posing a sort of a somewhat of a false binary, that those are the only options. You know, it may be that there's nothing that can be done. It may well be to stop this omnicidal juggernaut. I certainly feel that in my worst of times. But there's, you know, I don't know. I can, in some ways, because I'm not, you know, actively involved in a group now, I sort of hark back to my own personal, you know, glory days of involvement in movements, and seeing that, you know, like the, you know, the Extinction Rebellion, what, you know, what Greta Thunberg has inspired, you know, that there's the Youth Liberation Front now here in Portland that seems to be gearing up. There's examples still of, you know, minority small groups, you know, the Black Lives Matter, you know, the No DAPL, you know, these are all examples of situations that have gained some traction, and people have actually gotten together and resisted together. Yeah, and we have to resist together. And so the more we can resist together, and the idea that just doing some whatever it is will inspire, you know, the magical mass resistance that's going to overturn.
Well, like, I'm not that naive.
Well, you know, you're not. But I'm just sort of drawing it out to, you know, I the only thing that can actually have a chance is some kind of, you know, larger scale resistance. And the more one is able to do things that resonate, and actually get people organized together, the more effective they can be. And we've seen that happen for sure.
Well, like, even DAPL was infiltrated, you know, like the tools of coercion. I mean, it's just, you know, it's so over. I mean,
right.
You know, CountPointHelpPro, all that stuff, you know.
We know that. That's why I somewhat disagree with your saying that violent resistance is unethical and inherently unethical and counterproductive. I don't know that that's true.
I just didn't want to go there, you know, on a public radio program. I didn't want to get you in trouble for one thing.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, one can, you know, talk about these things. Obviously, people have supported, you know, revolutionary movements in Central America, in Asia, in Africa, elsewhere. You know, the reason why people haven't been able to do that in this country is because the overwhelming force. And yeah, you can't say publicly that we should overthrow the government violently. Yeah, you can't. I guess you can't say that. And once one starts to go down that path, it does get tricky, because, you know, you know there's laws against, you know, against organizing overtly in that way. So yeah, these are very difficult things. One can sort of edge up to them on the air, and I think that's, one should do that. But yeah, these are important things to talk about.
I think the Plowshares people are being sentenced. They've either been sentenced or they're about to be sentenced. But, like, I don't know, given this current, you know, it would be one thing if there were, like, you know, say, WTO style, if things were really, like, Occupy Wall Street, if it seemed like there was a mass movement building, or, like, Yellow Vests in France or something like that, that would be one thing. But it seems like in the USA, there, you know, everyone is so overworked. They have no free time. They can't even have a regular schedule. They have no idea from week to week what their schedule is even going to look like. You know what I mean? The tools that the capitalists are employing to just exploit people, it's like, it seems like we're at such a state where, you know, there's something admirable about the Plowshares people who are like, you know, we're just not going to, you know, and I don't have any illusions about it leading to a wider movement. It's just like, as like on a personal basis, on like how you can, you know, because it seems like there's a lot of like opportunism. Like, as much as I like Chris Hedges, it's like, dude, if you really believe all that, then why are you out walking around? You know what I mean? Like put your money where your mouth is. You know what I'm saying? Like, are we just talking about this? Is it just like a coffee clutch sort of thing? Or like, are we going to like actually, you know, say, hey, we can't go on like this. This is not tolerable. This is, you know, this is a complete travesty.
Yeah. Mario Savio's speech at the in Berkeley.
Throw yourself upon the wheels upon the gears and make the operators of the machine know that
it's constant. It's a constant challenge to us all, despite how the wheels have ground on since Mario Savio's day and created the nightmare of global warming and biosphere breakdown that we see. But, you know, persist we much. In response, I totally admire the plowshares. I admire anybody who stands up in, you know, whatever they do. Anyway.
Thank you so much, Paul. And thank you for just letting me talk. It's you know, for whatever value there is in it, I mean, you're helping me, like, get through the day. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, I'm glad for that. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, as often, a very wide-ranging discussion. When I open it up to challenging the dominant myths of our society, starting with Christmas, do we have another caller? Oh, looks like we got another caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Is that me? Is it my turn right
yep.
now? Hi, Paul. And first off, I'd just like to say it's just so enjoyable to hear your wonderful voice, whether it's 5:30 in the morning with folk music or with this topic right now. And I'm sitting by the fire next to my Christmas tree with my 12-year-old who's just walked in from his mother's house
Sweet.
At the end of the street. The radio. And there's, you know, 8 or 10 presents that I went to our local nature shop and had them wrap them for him and checked that box. I'm doing Christmas for my child.
All power to you.
And, yes. And so I believe in sharing gifts, and I believe in rituals that have their roots in lights and the middle of winter and cheer and taking care of people. So that's a little bit about Christmas. And then the other part about politics that you guys got into, I think there's something almost, full of ourselves, us white middle-class activists who think about going to jail en masse or whatever to stop this madness. Because, I mean, there's already so many millions of people in the world who are dealing with much worse than we are dealing with in Syria or in the Sudan or Yemen or in the Amazon rainforest. Those activists who have just been killed. It kills me. I want to share one paragraph from my good friend Freeman House, who worked for saving the salmon in the watersheds of the Toll River.
I remember him, yeah.
Yes, and he wrote, when he would go upriver to work on the salmon, catching the salmon to spawn the eggs out, he would sometimes stay at a Cistercian monastery near their remote watershed work up in the headwaters. And he enjoyed the respite of staying there at the monastery, both for the calming simplicity of the cabin and for the opportunity to chat with the abbess, a wise and elderly Belgian woman. Once, and this is back in the 80s, when one of those plague signals had just erupted in the world, Bhopal or Chernobyl or something, Freeman House found himself in a state of despair. What was the sense, he asked her, of pursuing this difficult work in the face of a social order disintegrating so rapidly that it may well mean the end of the world? What does it matter? She answered, her Flemish consonants sounding like a stream working its way around an obstacle. Say you know the end of the world is coming tomorrow morning. How do you want to face it? With a clear mind and an open heart. Yes. Now say the world isn't going to end. How do you want to wake up in the morning and approach your work? She pauses for effect, but not long enough for me to answer. With a clear mind and an open heart. End of the world or not, same answer. Go on with your work. Thank you, Paul, for all that you do.
Perfect. Say hi to your kid.
Yes. Take care.
Thank you. That was wonderful. In my best of times, that's how I look at things. It gets sometimes hard to have that abundance of spirit, shall we say, because what the world tends to do is undermine our abundance of spirit and channel it oftentimes not in necessarily good direction. So thank you for that. Wonderful words. Well, we have about 5 minutes left. Don't have see anybody lined up. 503-231-8187. Interesting book, The Battle for Christmas, talking about how the Puritans wanted to basically outlaw Christmas. Ironically speaking, since we've been talking about this supposed war on Christmas, because of the unruliness of the masses had to be channeled and curtailed, because they were basically challenging, despite the myth that, you know, they were all in it together, the Puritans, there was still class lines, and that, you know, that created a lot of problems for the Puritans, basically sort of, in some ways, internal contradictions led to the demise of the Puritans, plus the, you know, the massive immigration of lots of non-Puritans, and sort of the territorial expansion of the United States, leading to the more sort of, you know, the lessening of the importance of old New England, the good blue bloods thereof. But yeah, so the main point I guess I was making is the way that both the Romans and the Puritans sort of dealt with the Lord of Misrule, the more ancient sort of lower class midwinter celebrations. And anyway, so it looks like we got another caller. So go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Arthur.
Hello.
Hey, I want to, this is Christmas Day, I believe.
So they say.
I want to say hello to all the children locked in cages in Texas for Christmas. Because our Congress evidently has no power to stop our ICE and Border Patrol people from taking children away from their parents. So I want to wish a happy...
That's about all there is to say. The brutal, sordid hypocrisies of American culture and the tearing off of the veils would the people but see of the reality of America from massive immigration flooding the colonies and expanding the growing American Empire after they took over from the British, stealing the lands of the native folks, enslaving the Africans, encouraging massive immigration to then build the burgeoning industrial empire. And now that we've created such a monster, and the internal contradiction of capitalism making it such that there's these right-wing movements to lock young Central Americans in cages on the border. It's a sordid situation. That's my last thought for Christmas. So thank you to the last caller to bring that up. And yeah, I just recommend this book, The Battle for Christmas by Steven Nissenbaum, for some food for thought in addition to whatever else you're going to be eating and enjoying. And don't not enjoy. That's all I got to say. Freeman House's words to live with an abundance of spirit as much as we can in the face of the madness. All right, that's all I got to say. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Ozia.
In Indiana, claimed that the theme song for Mr. Ed, that old television show about the talking horse, if you played the Mr. Ed theme song backwards, it said, "Satan is the source."
disinformation. Misinformation.
Taking scissors to play with the black folk down in Florida. Colored pens and for sexing up the. I'm the someone who knew. They're not telling pre-September. I lean on in the loop to help them unremember.
I was flying on UA-93. That shadow in the footage, it was probably me. I'm the rumor, I'm the doubt, I'm the lie. But you wouldn't stand near me if you didn't want to die. Everything you know is wrong.
Misinformation.
There's a verse missing out of this song.
Misinformation.
Everything you know is wrong.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Time is now 9 a.m. Up next is Rising Up with Sonali.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friend.
Woohoo!